Good morning. I want to welcome you here this morning. I see visitors here and want to especially welcome you to be here and hope that you're blessed being here this morning. I'm going to go right into the message this morning, but before I introduce the subject of the message that I want to talk about this morning, I want to tell a story. A true story happened about 28 years ago in Kentucky. It's one of the, even today, 20 years later, I think in the history of the United States, it is considered the or one of the worst drunk driving accidents that ever happened. And some of you could easily remember it. I don't know. It was on Saturday, May 14, 1988, that there was a busload of 67 people, mostly youth, four adults, ranging from 10 years old into the teenagers, from different schools. It was on a Saturday. They had drove from Radcliffe, Kentucky, north up into Ohio to some theme park. They were there for the day, and they were on their way home that night, headed back south on I-71. And on their way home, they stopped and filled up their 60-gallon gasoline tank for this bus and got back on the road and were heading on south there. And just before 11 p.m., a little black Toyota pickup heading the wrong way, heading north instead of south in the southbound lane, hit that bus head on in the bus's right front corner. When that little pickup hit that bus, it broke the suspension and shoved a leaf spring from the bus back into that fuel tank. So that gasoline was dripping all over. And within just a little bit of time, the metal that was scraping on the asphalt, creating sparks, ignited that bus. And within a minute or two, the bus was filled with fire and smoke. Back then, that bus only had two exits. It had one in the front and one in the back. And the exit in the front, where it had been hit, was damaged. You couldn't open that exit. And that's where the flames were anyways. So all 67 of these, well, most of these people, immediately tried to exit out that back door. And the aisles on those buses are, I think, only like maybe 12 inches wide. Very narrow. And the bus was filling with smoke and was hot in just no time with the explosion of that gasoline. So it was just a traffic jam. And only six people out of the 67 made it out totally unharmed. 27 never did make it out alive. And the rest of the 34 were injured and burnt. The driver of that pickup is a 34-year-old man. His name was Larry Mahoney. He had serious injuries, was taken to the hospital, but he survived. He was tested for his alcohol content, and it was more than double the legal amount. Larry became the object of a national outcry, of course. You think of the tragedy of those children and the many, many lives that were killed. And Larry woke up the next morning in the hospital, and his two sisters came into the hospital, one on each side, and told him what he did. And he had no idea. He had no idea what had happened the last night. He just woke up in the hospital, and they told him the news. Larry was not an exceptionally bad man. He had one other DUI in his history, but I mean, he was 34 years old, so it wasn't like he had a tremendous amount of bad record for that age. He was just a normal man of that area. And I want to just read a little bit of clips out of some articles about some descriptions of this man that some other people, friends, and about him said. It said he was the second of four children to Mary and John Mahoney. Larry grew up in the small, well-kept house on a gravel road, high on a ridge overlooking the Kentucky River. Like most folks in the area, his parents made a living growing tobacco on contract. Larry's father is amiable and hardworking. His mother, Mary says, a friend, is straight and arrow as God ever shot out of his bow. It was a close family and still is. Mary's good food and good humor have always made her house a gathering place, says Larry's younger brother, Charlie. And even the married children find their way there several times a month. Larry Mahoney, says his friends in Little Worthville, Kentucky, was just about the nicest guy you could ever hope to meet. They say he was a good father to his children of two broken marriages, a steady worker over at the M&T Chemicals plant, a country boy fond of fishing and coon hunting. He was sweet, they say. He was shy. If you didn't meet him, you could never imagine how quiet and nice he was, says a friend. Sounds like a Mennonite, almost. Very nice family. Decent guy. But under the influence of alcohol, he couldn't think straight. Made a bad decision, and that changed the lives of people and his own forever. Last I knew, when I had checked, he's still alive in Kentucky, trying to live a quiet life. And I'm not trying to put Larry down at all. I'm simply using this story as an illustration. Now, the fact is, probably there was thousands of other guys drunk driving on the road on May 14, 1988, that just didn't hit a bus. That's probably the reality. Probably most of us know people personally that have ruined their lives, ruined other people's lives from the use of alcohol. There are many terrible things that happen every day because of drunkenness. There's broken homes, broken marriages. Children suffer. There's rape. There's murder. From people that aren't bad people, as we would say in society. Drunkenness is a sin. But I'm not here this morning to talk about the physical drunkenness of drinking too much alcohol. I don't think most of us here have that problem. But the subject that has been on my mind lately is the subject of spiritual drunkenness. And I want to think about that this morning. And before I get into that too much, though, I want to look a little bit at some of the symptoms, the stages a person goes through and the effects on the body, the natural body a person has as he takes in alcohol. And if you haven't shifted your mind to the spiritual application yet, start to do that as I read some of these effects. I've never been drunk, but they say as you drink, as you start to drink, the feeling, the warmth that comes over your body, it's a very good feeling. And the first stage of drunkenness is euphoria, just a buzz, a nice feeling. Your problems start to go away. Some other symptoms they would say is a boost of self-confidence, short attention span, poor judgment. And then you move into the second stage of excitement. The alcohol content level in your blood goes up. It affects people differently. Some become sleepy. Their vision is blurred. Senses are dulled. Phase three, they become more confused. Don't know where they are. Again, trouble seeing clearly. The sight is affected. Can become very aggressive or very affectionate. Now, fourth stage is they become in more into a stupor. Difficult moving around, starting to lose consciousness. And then five is a coma, where they're unconscious, don't know what's going on. Slow heart rate. And then the sixth stage is death. When your level gets to 0.5%, I guess you considered that you're probably dead. And the thing about alcohol, the scientific facts of blood alcohol content and its effects is no respecter of persons. There are different tolerances. It has to do with your metabolism and how much you can process alcohol. But if you take a man, you could take Jason, you could take any upstanding man, you could somehow get alcohol into his bloodstream. And you'd get that up to 0.24, which was about where Larry's was when he had that accident. As good as a man as Jason is, and as pure as he has lived, he would be drunk. He could not tolerate it, most likely. Spiritually, I want us to think about that. That there are things in our lives, I don't care who you are, that you can't take into your mind, your body, do, without becoming spiritually drunk. It is not a respecter of persons. And I find this interesting as I think about some of these different effects on the body. And I think back to what Jesus said as He talked about different teachings. As He talked to different people, He often warned about spiritual blindness. He talked about deafness. He talked about walking dead people, white sepulchers, out of it spiritually, unconscious, asleep, falling in the ditch. Those were things that He talked about. Describe a drunk man. Spiritual senses are dull. Not much. Not tuned in to what's really going on. 1 Peter 5:8 says, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary the devil is a roaring lion, walketh about, seeking who he may devour." And both in the devotional and the Sunday school, we talked about the battles and the adversary and those things, the fight, the race. We have an adversary this morning, the enemy that is seeking to destroy you and me. And he has many tactics. And some of his tactics are very clear. You can walk into the streets of Eugene and Portland and see the bold, satanic approach of Satan through drugs and through alcohol and through sex and through violence. He's very real. You can see the darkness. Some people are tested in places with persecution from either their countries or other religious groups. But I believe that the devil is more subtle than that at times. And here in the United States, we are facing a much different temptation and an attack. And the temptation many are facing is spiritual drunkenness. We live in a land that, unlike almost most places in the world, it's unrealistic. If you've only lived here and only been here, you think it's normal, but it's not. We live in a place of excess and extreme. Focus on comfort and pleasure and costly array. Entertainment, beautiful houses, beautiful cars, expensive hobbies and vacations. And you know, some of these things are not wrong in themselves. But as we drink of the pleasure of these things, I believe that we can become more and more intoxicated with the euphoria that those things bring to our body and to our physical comforts. And the spiritual senses become blurred and our judgment becomes impaired and our vision is not clear and we become desensitized to the real things. We become confused. We don't know what's going on. Thousands of years ago, God was concerned about that when He was getting ready to bring the children of Israel into the promised land, a land that was just flowing with milk and honey. And God wanted to give His people these things. And I think God, in a sense, still does. And yet He knew and He warned before they ever entered into that land. I want to read a few verses out of Deuteronomy 8:6. This is what God told the people. Starting at verse 6. Therefore thou shalt keep the commandments of the Lord thy God, to walk in His ways and to fear Him. For the Lord thy God bringeth thee into a good land, a land of brooks, of water, of fountains, and depths that spring out of the valleys and hills. A land of wheat and barley and vines and fig trees and pomegranates. A land of oil olive and honey. A land wherein thou shalt eat bread without scarceness. Thou shalt not lack anything in it. A land whose stones are iron, and out of whose hills thou mayest dig brass. When thou hast eaten and art full, then thou shalt bless the Lord thy God for the good land which He hath given thee. Beware that thou forget not the Lord thy God in not keeping His commandments and in His judgments and His statutes which I command thee this day. Lest when thou hast eaten and art full, and hast built goodly houses and dwell therein, and when thy herds and thy flocks multiply, and thy silver and thy gold is multiplied, and all that thou hast is multiplied, then thy heart be lifted up, and thou forget the Lord thy God, which brought thee forth out of the land of Egypt, from the house of bondage. And I'll stop reading there. And God wanted to bless His people with all these things. He's like a father with a son. He loves to give them these things. But it is so easy, like Romans 1 says, for us and for people, and God knew that, to start worshiping the creature and the creation more than the Creator. And I'm going to take the time quickly to read some verses in Revelation 18, and maybe you want to turn there with me. I'm going to read at least the first part of Revelation 18. And we're going to try to read them quickly, not too quickly, but that you can understand. But I want you to think about this chapter here, the fall of Babylon, and Babylon being a type of the world, I believe, of the earth. And a lot of these things, Babylon was falling, and you think about the list of things that are in here. Some of them are wrong, some of them are sin, but a lot of them are just God-given things. They're like we read in Deuteronomy. I'm going to read that at this time. One thing to think about as we go through this chapter, think about the good old US of A. Think about us. Think about you. Think about, there's two groups of people here. And which one am I in? I'm going to read the first, I think, 20 verses. And after these things, I saw another angel come down from heaven, having great power, and the earth was lightened with his glory. And he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become the habitation of devils, and the hold of every foul spirit, and a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Reward her even as she rewarded you, and double unto her double according to her works. In the cup which she hath filled, fill it to her double. How much she hath glorified herself and lived deliciously, so much torment and sorrow give her, for she saith in her heart, I sit a queen and am no widow, and I shall see no sorrow. Therefore shall her plagues come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she shall be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judgeth her. And the kings of the earth have committed fornication and lived deliciously with her, shall bewail her and lament for her, when they shall see the smoke of her burning, standing afar off for the fear of her torment, saying, Alas, alas, the great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour is thy judgment come. And the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, for no man buyeth her merchandise anymore. The merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones and of pearls and of fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and all fine wood and all manner of vessels of ivory and all manner of vessels of most precious wood and of brass and of iron and of marble and cinnamon and odors and ointments and frankincense and wine and oil and fine flour and wheat and beasts and sheep and horses and chariots and slaves and the souls of men. And the fruit that thy soul lusted after are departed from thee. And all things which were dainty and goodly are departed from thee, and thou shalt find them no more at all. The merchants of these things which were made rich by her stand afar off for the fear of her torment, weeping and wailing, and saying, Alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, for in 1 hour so great riches has come to naught, and every shipmaster and all the company and ships and sailors and as many as trade by sea stood afar off and cried when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, What city is like unto this great city? And they cast dust on their heads and cried, weeping and wailing, saying, Alas, alas, and all that ships in the sea by reason of her costliness, for in 1 hour is she made desolate. Rejoice over her, thou heaven, and ye holy apostles and prophets, for God hath avenged you on her. That's just a background. I'm not going to give a lot of comment on that. But there's two groups of people in here. I want you to think about that. One is rejoicing. Others are wailing and mourning. And as if you are to imagine everything that we have in the lives that we live going up in smoke, and we knew that Jesus was coming, would we wail or would we rejoice? One of the differences of physical drunkenness and spiritual drunkenness is that often a physical drunk doesn't take too much and you can see it. They're not too classy. They're not very, don't look too smart. They look foolish. They're staggering around, making a fool of themselves. But with a spiritual drunk, it's not that way. You know, a spiritual drunk can be a classy businessman, a beautiful woman, a strong youth, and be just comatized with spiritual drunkenness. I want to just go over a few things that came to my mind. The first one that I think are things that cause spiritual drunkenness. And the first one was mentioned here in Revelation 18, and it's also in the chapter previous, 17, verse 2. It talks about, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have made drunk with the wine of her fornication. Many of us can probably say that we're free from fornication, physical fornication. But are we really free from the drunkenness of fornication? And I believe that the use of technology has increased the ability for this and the probability of this among many of our people. And I think we have an epidemic that possibly we won't even know the effects for another generation. I know it's a big problem, but what I'm worried about is that it's bigger than we think. And we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg. And I hope that's not the way it is. But fornication of the mind and of the lust can just overwhelm a person that is involved in pornography, sensual, indecent reading material, filthy thought life, imaginations. A person that is filled with this, you know, this is somewhat like alcohol in the sense that it actually affects you and addicts you physically. It's more than a spiritual thing. And often, a man that is involved in this thinks he's hiding it. But the effects are there. The drowsiness, the effects that we read, the sleepiness spiritually. Proverbs says that this kind of lust will bring a man to a piece of bread. It also says, it compares it as an ox going to the slaughter, being led to the slaughter. And if you think of a 1,800-pound Black Angus bull, strong and powerful, that could drag 10 guys around on the end of a rope all over the pasture if it wanted to. When that beast, if that beast is filled with lust, it can just be walked right into the slaughterhouse to get its neck slit and to die. And that is a picture. That is a picture of what fornication, being drunk with that. A simple man that has no foresight beyond the passions of right now. And it blurs our vision. And it makes you so that we cannot make good judgment. It blurs our vision, blurs our judgment. So young men, old men, all of us, women, think it affects us all in some way. Stay free from that. It's intoxicating, it's addicting, it's destructive. There's many other sins we could mention that just kind of go with that. Music is that way. Movies is that way. I know how that is. You walk out of here, you can be in a church service like this, and you can go get in your pickup and put in that country or rock CD player, and it brings an euphoria to you. It feels good. Life is good. You feel strong. You feel big. You feel bulletproof. But you're spiritually drunk. There are many good things as well, that are not sins in themselves. And that's what I want to focus a little bit more on, maybe the rest, because I think it's fairly common sense that we can get caught up in a lot of sins that make us blind spiritually. But I want to go, I'm going beyond that, trying where my real heart of the message would have been thinking beyond those things. Things that if we are not disciplined in, if we just drink too much of, can take our spiritual edge and awareness off. And once that starts to deteriorate, I think we're on a slippery slope. First Corinthians, we just studied this verse a few weeks ago. All things are not lawful. All things are lawful unto me. But all things are not expedient. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be brought under the power of any. And I think that is a good verse that would teach that. That there's many good things that we can be involved in. But we can become under the power of them if we're not careful. And one of the first ones I just want to mention, and they're not in probably the right order, it doesn't really matter about the order, but just the spiritual drunkenness of simple pleasures. That covers a broad range. Pleasure is not bad. God gave us these things, I think, many things on earth to enjoy. And I think that it's good to be thankful and to use them as a time of refreshment. Beauty of nature, rejuvenating ourselves. It's good to go on some vacations. It's good to have a hobby, I think, to some degree. But it is easy to become in excess with these things. And you're obsessed with them. They control you. You just serve them. You know, the Bible really doesn't say that alcohol is a sin that I know of. It says the overuse of alcohol is a sin. We have chosen, I think because of the terrible effects that it has, is to just not be involved in it. But that's not, my point is that that's not what the Bible necessarily says. And the food, I'd like to just say about food a little bit. Food is the same way. Food is necessary. Food is good. I love food. I enjoy food. But when we take it in excess, it can consume us and control us. Proverbs 23:21, it says, it throws them together. And I think often gluttony and drunkenness are very similar. It says, the drunkard and the glutton shall come to poverty, and drowsiness shall clothe a man with rags. You know, overeating, at least when I do, I'm not fat, but I can overeat, and I have. And when I overeat, my spirit is usually not happy. I become groggy. I become more moody, I think, when I'm just full to the gills and have overeaten. Gluttony. I think that maybe that it is a, not to mention the spiritual drowsiness. I don't know if you have ever tried to study for a topic and just go eat, gorge yourself on a big meal, and then go in and try to actually dig in and study. It doesn't work for me. I think it affects us spiritually. I think it's a bigger problem than we'd like to admit. And I think possibly, just maybe to be fair, the youth get a lot, you know, they're vibrant, they're passionate, they're full of life, and we have lots of warnings for them. But I think food is the one thing that as we grow older and move out of that, we don't feel like playing volleyball, and we don't feel like hiking, and we don't feel like doing all these things anyways. We like a good meal. We like good food. And so we can become obsessed about this thing. And we can worship food, and we talk about food, and we dream about food, and we prepare for it and crave it. And then we go overeat in it. And then we joke about it. Proverbs 23 also, verse 2 says, "Put a knife to thy throat if thou be a man given to appetite." And there again, I just want to say, you know, most of these things that I'm mentioning are me, are things that I have to battle against. I can relate to them. Other things, simple things, sports, hobbies, hunting, fishing, and shopping. Many good things, when kept in their place, can be a blessing. But when they be overdone, they control us. Timothy 2, it talks about the last days there. And one phrase in verse 4 of chapter 3, it says, "In the last days, men shall be lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God." Go after the things that we enjoy. Pursuing those things. We love them. They're our life. Next thing I would want to just mention is the spiritual drunkenness from technology. And I think that is a very real one. Again, technology is something that is gradually consuming more and more, I think, of us in different ways. It's not, again, the youth, just the youth. It's the grandparents and us parents. There is a host of things when we say the word technology that falls under that. It's fascinating. It's intriguing. It catches our attention and holds us. You take a father, you take a little 3-year-old boy and he's got a phone and there's something going on in that, and you try to peel the attention away from that. It is absorbs and grabs you. And you see it all over. People walking all over. And I'm doing it too often. Looking down at your phone. Sometimes it's legitimate. Sometimes it's good things. It's running your business. But often, there's plenty of other things that we get caught up in. The entertainment, news addicts, and just constantly feeding on these things. Women, maybe you could talk about how this affects, possibly could affect you. You know, you can be in the home, wasting time in some virtual world on social media, caught up in the snare of peer pressure by people that shouldn't even be our peers, trying to impress people that don't really care about you. It's a trap. Just be careful. Remember that we are much bolder in the communication of technology than we are in real life. Online shopping, spending time and money that we don't have on things that we don't need. And all of us can be guilty of that. And there again, many of these things are tools that can be used in a good way. But I just think that we need to be aware. We need to be awake. If nothing else, they're often just extremely time-wasting activities. Rob us from real relationships and real life and real needs that are around us. Another one is the drunkenness of busyness. And some of these things were in Sunday school, thought about this. Busyness, and maybe throw in there the pursuit of money and things. Just busy. And I don't know how to deal with this, but it's something that I face. And I like to think that I try to want to make adjustments for this, to address this. But Luke 8:14, Jesus is talking, I think this is in the parable of the seeds that fell. And he said, "And they which fell among the thorns are they which, when they have heard, go forth and are choked with the cares and the riches and pleasures of this life, and bring no fruit to perfection." And there again, it's not bad things. It's just choking out the better things that should be getting done. There's no virtue in being lazy. But what are we doing to be busy? And I think that's one thing, whenever we warn against being too busy and pursuing too much, I think we need to be careful that we're not promoting hippies that are lazy and sitting around and not being a productive in society. I think we should be busy. But busy with what? Is it just my own life? Us men, we can have the drive to be somebody in life, to be rich, to be respected. And life can become a game, challenge, to see how far you can get, how fast you can get, how quick you can turn a dollar and grow our empire. It's fun. It's basically numbers and it's a game. We used to play a choir, enjoy it, just see how much you can get within a game. But as we win, I think, in life, and as we're successful, I think, again, there's an euphoria that comes into us, both physically and for sure spiritually. And we can become, the first stages of drunkenness can settle in and can easily get a hold of us. And if we're not careful, we wake up one day, we have spiritual decisions that need to be made, but we're too intoxicated to think clearly at that point. And like the rich young ruler, we just walk away. We walk back to what we really love, what we really want in life. You know, getting drunk feels good. At least that's what I am told. That's why people do it. If it hurt, they wouldn't do it. Spiritual drunkenness feels good too. And I think that's the one thing that we need to remember. It feels good, but it's not good. And so it's just a warning that, you know, not everything that we do or enjoy or feel that is good is bad. But it's not a safe guide to make decisions by what I feel like doing at the present time. Some antidotes I wanted to think about. I didn't know if I should build these in with each one as we went, but I just want to say a few things about what do we do when we're drunk? What do we do when we know we have a problem? And I think the first thing that a drunk man must do if he wants to be sober is recognize his problem and stop drinking. And that's a basic point. That is so simple that you probably missed it. But you see, you can have a man sitting on a park bench with a bottle in his hands, lamenting his broken life, lamenting what he's doing wrong in between sips, pouring the alcohol back into his system. Spiritually, we often will do the same thing. We can lament that this thing is a problem in my life. I know it's a problem in my life. I see the effects of it. I feel the effects of it. I recognize the drunken stupor that I'm in. Every other week, I'm into that pornography again on my phone or the internet. But we leave the internet hooked up. If we unhooked it, that would be legalistic. No, it wouldn't. It would be cutting off things that are feeding. It would be taking that bottle and putting it out of reach. It would be quit pouring the alcohol into your mouth. And that is the first step. We cannot continue to take in these things hoping that one day we'll just wake up free and sober. another thing they say that helps a drunk person try to flush it out once he's drunk is to drink lots of water. To try to dilute the alcohol content in your body as quick as you can. Just drink lots of water. Flush it out. And I would like to say that in John 4:14, Jesus said that whosoever drinketh of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst. But the water that I shall give him shall be in him a well of water springing up into everlasting life. And when we have drunk those things of the world and we know that our body is full of these toxins, God has given us these wholesome solutions, I believe, to spend time drinking and feeding to try to reverse this thing out of my system and get something else in control of my life. I think giving and being generous with our money and the things and our time, maybe time is more costly than money for some of us, is an antidote to the busyness and to the drive. I know that does for me sometimes, is just to not care about it. Just give it. Let it go. Let it be somebody else's. We like to justify, well, he'll not use it right. That's not good stewardship. That's all right. It's probably better than hoarding it. Fasting. Fasting should be a sermon of itself, I think. Fasting is an interesting thing. I don't understand for sure. Slightly I do, but I don't understand fully the whole process and the depth of fasting and prayer that Jesus taught. But I think it's a very overlooked spiritual tool. It's the opposite of drunkenness. It's the opposite of excess. It's the discipline. It's the restraining from the things that we love and enjoy on purpose. And the reason that it's so underused is because it's uncomfortable. It's the opposite of drunkenness. It doesn't feel good. It hurts. We get a headache. We become weak. We become shaky. And I want food. But I think there's something that happens when we are willing to do that and do that for the right reasons and do that in faith. Fasting coupled with prayer to rid our body of those things, I think, sharpens our spiritual senses to where that we can start to see and where we can make judgment calls clearly. We become sober-minded and our spiritual judgment becomes sharper. Prayer along with that. Personal prayer. Now, I would just say that if you never feel the need to pray, never really, I know there's the side of it we talk about where it takes work, it takes discipline, but if you can just go through life day after day and no need, don't feel the need for a prayer every once in a while, and to go to prayer meeting every once in a while at least, you're probably spiritually drunk and desensitized, and something is controlling you. If you have no appetite for that, fast and pray. Be still, like we heard in Sunday school again. Meditate. Be still and know. Take time. You know, for those that are going, not going, I mean, on the outreach, those of us that are staying, what are we going to do now? That project's almost behind us, for all practical purposes. What are we going to do? Sigh of relief. Settle in. Pour ourselves into our work, our businesses, our good lives, our goodly houses, our goodly foods. I don't know how it is for you, but I have already felt those feelings, those desires just to... And I don't know. I think we have to live. I think we have to do these things. But I think we need to be very careful to not to let that overcome us and rule us and take control of our hearts. Let's not be like the Laodiceans. I have to mention them at least. And Jesus warned, they were the ones that had everything. It was nice, it was comfortable. But they were dead. We don't want to wake up at the end of our life like Larry Mahoney did. And when we wake up, we're headed north in a southbound lane. And there's lives that are strewn along the way. And there's eternity to pay for poor decisions that we have made. I'm going to read just four verses in closing out of Romans 13, 11 through 14. It says, "And that, knowing the time, that now it is high time to awake out of sleep, for now is our salvation nearer than when we believed. The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Let us cast off the works of darkness, and let us put on the armor of light. Let us walk honestly as in the day, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envying. But put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof." Let's have a song.